Good morning from Northern California. It's New Year's Eve. And last night I tried to read the next few chapters in Emily Carr's Growing Pains. But I had coughing fits and it just didn't work. I listened to a little bit of it this morning and I thought, no, I gotta re-record those. Hopefully I can get through it without too much sniffing and coughing. So this morning, it's windy as heck here in Northern California. It's like a storm blowing in, but there's no clouds. It's just wind, gusty, cold wind, blowing the trees everywhere and the branches all over the street. I remember days like this. It's good to be inside the studio. Later this afternoon, I will be headed back into the studio. I've been doing lots of rearranging, getting ready for the new year. I'm getting ready to take my big table that I have in there and take it down a notch so that I can stand or sit at it and do some flat drawing and flat work painting instead of having to get on the floor to do that. All these years I've been using the floor as my flat table surface. I rarely sit at a drawing table. And so that'll be new this year for me, is to have a place where I can actually sit or stand at rather than having to be on my knees. And so onward we go into the next chapters. I'm going to read Love and Poetry. Remember, she's back in Victoria now, I believe. Love and Poetry and The Voyage and Aunt Amelia are the ones I want to read. Maybe I'll get to Aunt Amelia's pig house. We'll see how far it goes here. All right, enjoy. Love and Poetry. Immediately upon my return from the West Coast mission, I tasted two experiences for the first time, love and poetry. Poetry was pure joy, love more than half pain. I gave my love where it was not wanted. Almost simultaneously, an immense love was offered to me, which I could neither accept nor return. Between hurting and being hurt, life went crooked. I worked and taught for all I was worth. When my teaching for the day was over, with a book of poetry under my arm and with my dog, I went to the beach or roamed the broom bushes on Beacon Hill. From the underscored passages in my poetry did not touch love as deeply as it touched nature and beauty for me. Marked passages are all earth and nature. I have to say, I might be taking breaks in between some of these passages to sip some water. But this is a good enough time because last night I was on Twitter and I had posted a... I can feel something in my throat. That's what's making me cough. I had posted a 2018 book list. And I had looked at it, and it was mostly all fiction. And I thought, wow, you know what? I don't really read fiction much. In fact, hardly ever. Art books and art history and biographies or autobiographies of artists is kind of my repertoire. I mean, sometimes, of course, politics and different things like that, social issues. But I rarely do because I think I got into that habit when I was in college. I'm a late bloomer in college. I didn't get my degree until I was an adult. I mean, a full adult, having kids already. But, excuse me. But why I bring that up is a friend, I had asked for, does anybody have nonfiction titles to add to this? Because the list had only a couple, a book of poetry and something else. And my friend from Vancouver chimed in with a list of his, and and I mentioned that I was reading Emily Carr's autobiography. And he said he came back with that he, in the 70s, had lived in her home, right across from Beacon Hill Park, which we just read about. And what happened was he had read something about her home and went kind of looking around it. And this was back in the 70s. And I should pull up the text or the Twitter feed. I'm not going to do that right now. But anyway, I'll try to just remember what he said. Oh my gosh, this might be difficult to read again today. So, what the point is, he had gone digging around and in the attic, opened an attic door or something, and he found a couple of her paintings on the ceiling of the attic. And he and his wife lived there. That's where he and his wife lived at the time. Evidently, he came back with the next part of it because I said, wow, that's really fascinating. And I never did ask him what happened to the paintings, you know. Well, he came back with that, I guess they were evicted or something, but they soon turned the house into, like, a historical landmark, basically, or something, and where everybody can go in and look at those now, I suppose. I was there in Victoria this summer, briefly. I went there, took a ferry ride across from Vancouver. On my way home, I took a different route home so I could see a little bit more of Canada, and I just browsed around Victoria for like a few hours, so I didn't even know anything about her home being there. But I find that fascinating that I guess those paintings were worth something, obviously. So that was my digression. Here's the next part of this chapter. Up to this time, my painting had followed the ordinary art school curriculum, drawing from the antique, still life painting, portraiture, design, and landscape. Now, it took a definite list towards pure landscape. When dangling from the studio rafters, the old pair of hoarding shoes were crammed with money from my teaching, I announced, I'm going to London. You have friends or relatives there? Asked an old lady friend. I have neither, but for my work, I must go. London is big, much noise, many people. You will miss your pine trees and your beaches, child. London will be beastly, all the same. I'm going. My sister, Amelia Green, accepts a few paying guests. What are paying guests? Boarders? My dear, ladies of good family in England do not take boarders. If circumstances compel them to accept remunerative, oh my gosh, I tried to get this word last night. I can't make my mouth do it. Let me take a glass of water again. Remunerative, I think it is. Remunerative, there it is. Visitors, they called them paying guests, said the shocked old lady. Said the shocked old lady. I'm sorry, I have fun with this, the way she writes. Then she says, PGs? Then all right, I'll be one of your sister's PGs. It was arranged that Aunt Amelia, wearing something green in her buttonhole, should meet me at Euston Station. Nearly everyone in Victoria gave me a life-size portrait photograph of himself, or sometimes of the entire family grouped. I was supposed to cart them along as a preventative for homesickness. I locked them into my stowaway cupboard at home. But more friends brought more photographs to the boat side. On entering my stateroom, I was greeted by cardboard stairs, male and female, propped against the tooth mug, the water bottle, the camp stool. A family group rested on my pillow. This is hilarious to me. The nicest family of all slid out the porthole, undulating on a great green wave. It smiled back at me. I gathered the rest into my cabin trunk. I could not be comfortably seasick with them looking on. I was provided also with a bale of introductory letters asking people to be kind. If England could not be kind for my own sake, I did not want charity niceness from my friends' friends. Oh, I love this about her. She's so, I don't know, obstinate. I love it. I guess that's called rebellious, huh? I guess that's why I relate. I love it. Canada's vastness took my breath. The up and downness of the Rockies, their tops dangled in clouds, thrilled and were part of natural to me. No, thrilled and were part of natural me, though I had to steel myself as we glided over trestle bridges of great heights spanning gorges and ravines with rivers like white ribbons boiling far below and lofty trees looking crouched and squat down there and squat down there in the bottom of the canyon while we slid over their tops. Typical run-on sentence with her. I guess it's going to be okay for me to write and run on sentences. Oh, I love that. Let me read that again because I really like that whole thing. If I can read it properly, I put in my own punctuation. That's a big long sentence, actually. It goes on and on and on. Canada's... Okay, that's the first part. That's the short part. Canada's vastness took my breath. Here's the run-on. The up and downness of the Rockies, their tops dangled in clouds, thrilled and were part of natural me, though I had to steel myself as we glided over trestle bridges of great heights spanning gorges and ravines with rivers like white ribbons boiling far below and lofty trees looking crouched and squat down there in the bottom of the canyon while we slid over their tops. We squeezed through rocky passes, hid in tunnels, raced roaring rivers, slunk through endless levels of dead, still forest, black, green, and mysterious, layer upon layer of marching trees, climbing trees, trees burned, trees fallen, myriad millions of trees, and loneliness intertwisted. Our engine gulped, endless miles, each rail length, one bite. On, till the mountains ended, and the train slithered over level land, munching space rhythmically as a chewing cow. Was there never to be an end? Did our engine spin track as she advanced like a monster spider? Would we finally topple over the brink into that great bonfire of a sunset when we came to the finish of this tremendous vastness? No rocks, no trees, no bumps, just once in a great, great way, a tiny house, a big barn, cattle in that great space, sizing no bigger than flies, prairie houses, cows, barns, drowned in loneliness. When at last we came to Canada's eastern frontier, just before she touched the Atlantic Ocean, she burst into a spread of great cities, clean new cities. The greedy gobbled train turned back to regobble Canada's space, while we launched into sea bounce that grieved the stomach, wearied the eye. Nothingness, nothingness, till you're seeing longed and longed. Whale, bird, anything rather than nothing, piled on top of nothing. The Voyage and Aunt Amelia. The woman in the deck chair next to mine stroked a strand of red hair from her forehead with a freckled hand. "Oh, my head! Have my smelling bottle." She took three long sniffs and then pointed the bottle across the deck. "Awful woman," indicating a loud lounging woman in noisy conversation with the captain. "Discussing whiskey, Irish against Scotch. Glad she prefers Irish. I should feel her preference for Scotch a desecration of my country." Captain crossed the deck. He looked inquiringly from one to the other of us. "Miss Carr?"
"Yes, Captain."
"This lady wants to meet you. Her maiden name was Carr." The captain indicated the loud woman with whom he had been discussing whiskey. The captain's lady flopped noisily into the chair that the smelling bottle and the Scotch lady had hastily vacated. By the way, that's her writing, Scotch lady. I think it's more known now as Scots, if you're talking about somebody from Scotland. But anyway, she wrote Scotch lady, had hastily vacated. "Any London relatives?" she asked sharply.
"None."
"What are you by birth?"
"Canadian."
She beckoned the captain back to her side. Irish versus Scotch was again discussed. They forgot me. She beckoned the captain. Oh, sorry. Suddenly I felt awful. The former Miss Carr made a swift move. I felt the cold, scratchy hardness of an immense sunburst which Mrs. Downey, the former Miss Carr, wore upon her breast. Then I was in my berth, and my cabin was full of people, but most full of Mrs. Downey. Sometimes I was there, sometimes not. Finally, I sailed out into blankness entirely. In those times, CPR boats took 10 days to cross the Atlantic. We were almost across before I woke. First, I thought it was me crying. Then I opened my eyes and saw it was stewardess. "Are you hurt?" She patted me and mopped herself. How could your mother send you this great way alone?"
"Mother's dead. I am older than I look."
The captain, doctor, stewardess, and Mrs. Downey had been in conference. A girl belonging to no one, and for the moment not even to herself, had to be landed. It was a problem. Stewardess had volunteered to take me home with her for the week that she was in port and nurse me, but now I had waked up. They carried me to the upper deck for air. We were lying in the Mercy, not landing our passengers till morning. The air revived me. Doctor said I might take the special boat train in the morning, providing there was anyone going my way who would keep an eye on me. There was not, until Mrs. Downey made it her business and changed her route. She sent stewards scuttling with wires. Miss Green was to meet me at Euston, just because a girl had her maiden name. Mrs. Downey made it her business to see I was delivered safe and sound in competent hands.
The ship's little Irish doctor saw us comfortably tucked into our train. I heard Mrs. Downey say, "Then come on up. I'll give you a time." The doctor waved his cap. I could not lie back resting, as Mrs. Downey wanted me to. We were skimming across the old world, a new world to me, entirely different, pretty, small. Every time I looked at Mrs. Downey, she was looking at me. Suddenly she said, "You're not a going to that Amelia person, you're a coming to me." "I'm promised to Miss Green, Mrs. Downey." "She's no relative. Bust the promise, I'll fix her. 'Twon't cost you nothing living with me. You can go to your school, but nights and Sundays you'll companion my little daughter." "Have you a daughter?" "Same age as you, 'flicted, but we'll all have good times, you and me and my girl." "That doctor chap is stuck on you. He told me so. I was looking for company for my Jenny. Only just happened, affliction." She choked, snuffled. As we pulled into Euston's sordid outskirts of grime and factories, the station's canopied congestion threw a shadow of horror over me. "That white, pinched little woman has green in her buttonhole, Mrs. Downey." "She's not getting you." Her fingers gripped my arm as in a vice. "Miss Green?" The two women stared at each other belligerently. "She's coming to me. Been sick. Not fit to be among strangers, she isn't. I'm her friend." "I'm promised, Mrs. Downey. My people expect it." The wiry claw of the lesser woman wrenched me away so that I almost fell. I was clutched fiercely back to the scratchy sunburst, then released with a loud smacking kiss. "Anyhow, come and see my little girl. She needs..." The woman choked and handed me a card and turned away. "Frightful person! The entire platform must have heard that vulgar kiss," gasped Miss Green. "I was very ill on board. She was kind to me, Miss Green." "You must never see her again. One cannot be too careful in London." She glanced at the address on the card in my hand. "Brixton? Impossible. I shall have to go just once to thank her and to return her umbrella. She gave it to me to carry while she took my heavier things." "You can post the umbrella. I forbid you to associate with vulgar people while living in my house." "I am going once." Our eyes met. It was well to start as I meant to continue. I was only Miss Green's PG. My way, my life were my own. It was well she should understand from the start. I have to laugh. I had thought this title said Aunt Amelia's Pig House. It's Aunt Amelia's PG House. I have a funny way of adding in letters now, or twisting letters around. I've noticed as I read out loud, I've not had that problem before, but maybe as I get older, my eyes are going more lax or something, and I'm dyslexic and stuff. I don't know. So here's the last part of this reading. Aunt Amelia's PG House. London was unbearable. August was exceptionally hot. Aunt Amelia lived in West Kensington, one of those houses in a straight row, all alike and smeared with smug gentility. I felt the shackles of propriety pinch me before the door was shut. The six PGs, without one direct look amongst them, disdainfully took me in at lunch. Colonial, I felt, was their chilly, sniffy verdict. I hated them right away. Their hard, smooth voices cut like ice skates, deering each other, while they did not really like each other one bit. The moneyed snob who had... I'm sorry. I gotta be careful about laughing because it makes me all coughy. The moneyed snob who had the big front room swayed the establishment. Next came the opulent Miss Oopsie, a portrait photographer who only portrayed titles. The PGs dwindled in importance till at the tail came Miss Green's niece, a nobody who was the snootiest of the lot and earned her keep by doing unnecessary things that were good form around the PG house. London stewed, incorporating the hot murk into her bricks all day and spitting it out at you at night. The streets were unbearable. Everyone who could get out of London had got and were not missed. I used to wonder where any more population could have squeezed. Certainly, if there were many more people in London, they would have to ration air for the sake of fairness. I really like the way she uses words. I have been meaning to say that for the last few chapters. This piece right here, London stewed, incorporating the hot murk into her bricks all day and spitting it out at you at night. And some of those other cherished passages. Back to the text. Miss Green, is there any place one can go to breathe? There are London's lovely parks. Just as crammed, just as hot as everywhere else. Miss Green clicked. Dear me, you Canadians demand a world apiece. I have offered to take you to Hyde Park. Show you our titled people, riding and driving. But no, you Canadians have no veneration for titles. Jealousy, I presume. I'll admit I do prefer cool air to hot celebrities, Miss Green. Now, about a breathing place? Kew, if it is roots and bushes you want, go to Kew Gardens. To Kew I went. That's K-E-W. I hope I'm saying that right. Kew. The great gates of Kew Gardens were plastered with many notices. Nobody's allowed in these gardens unless respectably attired. No person may carry a bag, parcel, or basket into the gardens. All such impedimenta to be checked at the porter's lodge. No one may carry food into the gardens. Tea may be procured in the tea houses. You must not walk upon the grass or run or sing or shout. Striding past the lodge, clutching my bag, I walked down the main way and turned into a woodsy path, began to sing. First hint of autumn was in the air. There were little piles of dead leaves and fallen twigs burning. Shreds of blue smoke wandered among the trees deliciously. Kew was a bouquet culled from the entire world. I found South America and Asia, Africa, China, Australia. Then I found Canada, even to a grove of pines and cedars from my own province. I rubbed their greenery between my hands. It smelled homey. I stabbed my nose on our prickly blue pine. I sat down on the grass beneath a great red cedar tree. From close by came the long-drawn cry of a peacock. Suddenly, I was back in the old barn studio. I threw up my chin and gave the answering screech which my peacock had taught me. My beauty on the old barn roof. I waited for an ejecting keeper, but my teacher had taught well. No keeper came. I went back to stuffy West Kensington, refreshed, happy. Again, Miss Green, in company with that swell who snobbed it over her PGs, offered to conduct me to see the Hyde Park parade. The swell boarders, Miss Green told me, always sat on penny chairs. Maggie's trying to look through the blinds. Okay, I didn't open the blinds yet. All right, let's do that for you. Sorry for the interruption. Otherwise, she'll just keep pawing at it. There, girl, look at all the wind.
Where was all this wind coming from? From the north? From Canada? Canada's cold right now. It's snowing up there. Let's see, where was I? Where was at the end of this chapter? Oh, hi, Maggie. You want to say hello? I went back to stuffy West Kensington, refreshed, happy. Again, Miss Green and company, with that swell who snobbed it over her PGs, offered to conduct me to see the Hyde Park Parade. The quote-unquote swell boarders, Miss Green told me, always sat on penny chairs. Much more refined than to sit on a free bench, my dear, drawled Miss Green. I'd rather go to the zoo, I replied, and went. Resignation, if not content, was in the eye of the captive creatures. Having once acquired a taste for the admiration and companionship of man-animals, Having once acquired a taste for the admiration and companionship of man, animals like it. Here and there you saw a rebellious or morose newcomer furiously pacing, but most of the creatures were merry, and all were well tended. All here looked more satisfied with life than the weary great looked in Hyde Park. I loved Q. That's it for today. Thank you for listening. Our next chapters will be St. Paul's, which is a Westminster School of Art, I believe. St. Paul's, Letters of Introduction. They're very short chapters. Westminster Abbey, Architectural Museum. Those are the few I'll get to next time. In the meantime, enjoy and have a happy new year to you, and keep safe and sound and dry and warm and cozy, and bring in the new year as you'd like. Ta-ta to 2019, my last recording for 2018. Be well.